What's come up for me is realizing how much it's affected my habits, my operating systems, and my relationships. And it's been very challenging to unpack all of that and realize that, but also having grace with myself of knowing that healing's not linear and that there's lots of different ways that that can happen. That's why I was inspired, and when we wanted to collaborate, that was really hit home for me.
So that's Teresa, and together with Jill McMahon, who's another friend of mine, and this dude named Rob, I know he loves being described that way, we are putting on this incredible one-day retreat called Relief from Grief, a grief relief retreat. How about it? If you're really struggling, it's an opportunity for you to, as I like to say, let some air out of the tires. We've just had the most incredible day planned with movement and mindfulness, and this equine therapy that Rob does is just, man, is it, you know what the word is? It's transformative. It's that powerful. And then we're going to have this beautiful river ceremony to honor your loved one. And then we're going to wrap up with this nice dinner and a campfire. And you're going to leave with a new community of people and some tools to help you manage your stress around grief a little bit better. It should just be an awesome day. And if you'd like to be a part of it, you can visit my Instagram page at Matthew Blades Media, MatheWBlades Media, Matthew with one T. And if you click that little link in bio thing, boom, it's the first thing that shows up, okay? October 14th up in Scottsdale. Would love to see you there. If this speaks to you, go hit that link right now, okay? All right, we're going to get to our podcast in just 1 second. First, a quick reminder that we've got some really incredible resource partners that are a part of the program now. And these are folks that I would love to send you to if you want to continue on your journey of healing, whatever that might look like, right? We've got resource partners that deal with plant medicine and psychedelics and veterans. And then we've got others that are handling grief. And we've got other folks that are cardiologists and other folks that are doing these spiritual experiences. And so there's all kinds of people. And if you'd like to meet them, you can click the resources tab at learnfrompeoplewholivedit.com or hang in there with me right now as I tell you about them. So almost every week of my life for the last 2 years, somebody will ask me about the retreat that changed my life, and I'm so proud to present Spirit Quest as one of our official resource partners. Founded in 2007, it's the holistic wellness center that changed my life, helped me overcome anxiety, helped me work through conflict, gave me all these tools to manage stress, and they would love to do the same thing for you. To connect to Spirit Quest, click the link on our resources tab at learnfrompeoplewholivedit.com, and when you get on the phone with them, make sure you mention that you heard it on Learn From People Who Lived It. You've probably heard me say this before, but most of the things that kill us are preventable, and that's exactly why I put my heart in his hands, in his care. I'm talking about Dr. Robert Todd Hurst and HealthSpan MD. He's my cardiologist because I appreciate his holistic approach to heart health. There's nothing out there like HealthSpan MD, his AFib reversal program, his CAD reversal program. Get the link on the resources page at learnfrompeoplewholivedit.com. At Metal Joe, they sell more than shirts. They sell apparel with a purpose. In fact, my favorite hoodie in my closet is a Mental Joe hoodie. They help out G.I. Joes to the average Joes one t-shirt at a time. With every purchase, you help them support organizations that can provide services to help others get out of their heads and into their bodies through plant medicines, equine therapy, yoga, and other non-traditional mental health treatments. Link to them. Pick out your favorite t-shirt or hoodie right now at learnfrompeoplewholivedit.com/resources. One of our proud resource partners is Eric's House. Here's the deal. Nothing quite prepares us for the heartache of a profound loss. And grief isn't a problem to be fixed, but rather a normal reaction to loss. So when somebody you love dies, it might feel like everything you once knew is true has changed. When we experience that loss, especially the ones that are really unexpected, like suicide or addiction, grief is complicated. That's where the community at Eric's House comes in. Link to them on the resources page at learnfrompeoplewholivedit.com.
Looking for no bullshit conversation about mental health? Find Learn From People Who Lived It wherever you get podcast. Search it using all one word. Learn From People Who Lived It.
Welcome to another episode of Learn From People Who Lived It.
All right, look at us. We are here for another episode of Learn From People Who Lived It. We've been working on all these technical problems. Oh, the host is awful on this show. Isn't that the truth, Tawny?
Who do I report? Who do I give feedback to?
Yeah, I'll get you a direct link. And then if you wouldn't mind on Yelp leaving the same review. So we're going to hang out today with Tawny Lara and have, I think it's going to be a really cool and incredible conversation. But first up, for those that are listening on the podcast and are not looking at us right now, Tawny is in her Manhattan apartment. Is that where you are?
I am.
Okay. And on your mint green wall right behind you, there is a series of what looks to be newspaper clippings or something like that. And then obviously I see the cover of your new book, which is coming out, called Dry Humping, which we are so going to talk about. what's all those clippings behind you?
They are newspaper clippings from when I wrote for my local newspaper in Waco, Texas. I was 14 and I wrote basically op-eds. I didn't know what they were at the time.
Yeah.
But I wrote some pretty controversial stuff for a teenager in Waco, Texas. I wrote about gay marriage, legalizing weed, abortion. Yeah, I can't believe they printed it.
Good for you.
I got hate mail. I literal hate mail. Like back then, before there were internet trolls, people had to actually write a letter and then write the address and then put a stamp on the envelope and then make sure that they had to really, really hate you.
They did. It was none of it this. It's just fake hate for fleeting
hate. It's so easy now. Back then, the haters were a lot. I think they were, I don't know, maybe there were less of them because it required more effort, but man.
Listen, I used to say when we got a complaint on radio, if we got an actual letter, I would say to the gang, I would be like, this is incredible. Do you know how much effort went into this thing?
Exactly.
And she had to sit down at the table, get the paper, find a pen this thing, look up our address, mm-hmm. put a stamp on it, bring it to the post office. She has to really be pissed.
She had a lot to say. She needed to be heard.
Oh my gosh, I love it. Well, okay, so you got this new book. It's called Dry Humping. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. Your journey started probably, what year, 2015? Is that where things start to get a little real for you?
Yeah, I came from the, you know, stereotypical bartender, party girl. Think of your like archetype of a bartending party girl. That was me. Okay. I was dancing on bars, woo, to all the music. You know, I was obnoxious. And when I left, this was in Waco, Texas, where I was writing, you know, just 10 years before, where I was writing about really interesting topics, got kind of lost along the way into the world of substance abuse. And I quit drinking shortly after moving to New York City to pursue writing. And I got sober at 29 in the year 2015. And what you and I were talking earlier, when I got sober, it's really when I met me for the first time.
Why did you feel like you had to get sober?
So I love this question because there is this common trope that you have to hit rock bottom and lose everything to reevaluate your relationship with alcohol.
Right.
And while that looks great on screen, it's quite cinematic and dramatic. Yeah. That's not how it always is. It was not like that for me. I was at a pub in Soho with a couple coworkers talking about how I don't have enough time to write. They were talking about how they don't have enough time to, you know, fill in the blank. We all moved to New York to pursue something. And it finally hit me when I left the pub. I just spent 4 hours talking about how I don't have time to write. But I was drinking and there was something there. And while my drinking had calmed down a lot since I left the bartending world, I was still a heavy drinker. I drank until I blacked out on a regular basis. And I, you know, left that pub and it just clicked. I was like, okay, maybe alcohol really is standing in the way of me, you know, as corny as it sounds, being the best version of myself. And that's exactly what it what it was. I was right. And the next morning I woke up and I was like, I'm not going to drink today. I'm not going to drink for a week, 2 weeks. Then my 30th birthday was coming up and I was just like, okay, what if I don't drink for my 30th year and I blog about it? You know, this is 2015. Everyone was blogging back then. And I started this blog called sobrietyparty.com. And it was a very cringeworthy, earnest account of early sobriety. And the blog really held me accountable to both not drinking and to write consistently. And it was just supposed to be a year-long social experiment. And spoiler alert, it's been almost 8 years since I quit drinking. And I think my experiment was correct.
Yeah. So I'm fascinated by another question that I want to ask you, which is, why did you drink?
Yeah. And I think that's such a great question because people often think, if I could just stop drinking, everything will get easier. If I could, or if my partner could just stop drinking, everything will be better. And I didn't know this till I got sober, but alcohol abuse is very rarely the problem. It's a symptom of a much larger problem. Sure. And for me, that larger problem was undiagnosed anxiety, PTSD, and depression. And once I quit drinking and I finally started to take care of myself by going to yoga, going to therapy, hanging out with healthy friends and surrounding myself with healthy, positive people, then I was able to actually meet myself, address the anxiety and depression and PTSD, get on proper medication, learn some correct tools instead of self-medicating with drugs and alcohol like I did for years, for over a decade.
Yeah, and it's hard, right? And then you get to that moment of clarity, and for everybody, it looks a little bit different. I'll share with you my story really quick, and for those that have heard my podcast, feel free to skip right over this. But I am 2006, so it's 2006. My wife and I live in Denver, Colorado. We've got a six-month-old baby at the house, and I am a fucking raging alcoholic. And I'm not like the guy who's sloppy. I'm a real good functioning alcoholic who just drinks a lot at night and you know, wine and scotch. And so somehow I've made up my mind that it's okay what I'm doing and all these things. So long story short, we have a big company party. I tear it up at this company party. I decide I'm not ready to be done. I go out, I find some more booze. I come home, I can't find my keys. The knock on the door, it's like midnight. My wife answers, she's crying, the baby's crying. And the only thing I can do, Tani, is pass out, go to sleep. Mm-hmm. And the next morning I woke up and I wrote both my wife and my six-month-old son a letter. And I said, I will never touch alcohol again as long as I live. Was there anything like that for you? Like you said, you didn't really wait for it to fall off the rails. You just kind of decided maybe I don't want to do that anymore. Is it something maybe you haven't said yet?
Yeah. I mean, it's, and thank you so much for sharing. It's like, it's really fascinating to hear how people come to recovery from all different ways. You know, right. The moment I decided to stop drinking was not a like quote unquote traditional rock bottom moment, but you could definitely argue that I was living in a rock bottom. You know, I was binge drinking on a regular basis, which meant that I was living a very dangerous, reckless life. I drove drunk. I had unprotected sex. I got into really unhealthy, toxic relationships. I stayed in the bartending world. It took me 10 years to finish college because I kept dropping out. I mean, I was really struggling and I knew how to hide it. I didn't know I was struggling. I just knew I liked to party because I wasn't feeling anxiety and PTSD, right? So once I removed the alcohol, then shit got real. Then it's like, okay, now I have to actually deal with this stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's the work. That's the really difficult work of, you know, I would say sobriety is the quote unquote easy part. It's the it's quote unquote easy to not drink. You have to figure out why you drank, and then you have to learn healthy coping mechanisms that you have to use every day moving forward. That's fucking hard.
That is hard. Yeah. Well, and here we go. We got a great opportunity for those that are watching. I put up a little picture in the top right there, but that's your podcast called Recovery Rocks, which is 5 years in the making. Look at you. This is incredible to have a 5-year podcast. I'm so jealous. How did that come to be? And then how do you know Lisa, and why do you guys do this together?
So Lisa and I met on Instagram, of course.
She did. Yeah.
We met and it was 2016. It was my very first sober birthday, and Lisa had a book signing, and I went, I wanted to celebrate 1 year alcohol free meeting this awesome woman who wrote a book. So, I DM'd her and I was like, "Hey, I'm 1 year sober. I want to come support your book, yada, yada." The sweetest thing, don't know this woman. You know, we right. followed each other on Instagram. I go to her book launch. She brings me her 1 year chip, and she gives me her 1 year AA chip, and that I still have it to this day. It just warms my heart that the minute I met this woman, she extended that to me.
Yeah.
And we just stayed we were very close ever since. She took me under her wing, and she, knew that I was writing. And so she helped me with writing, and she helped me really find my voice as a writer. She also was like, "Hey, I want to," she was leaving the law. She was a lawyer. So she was transitioning from the legal field into public speaking. You know, her book did really well, and she couldn't do it all. So she was, transitioning into full-time public speaking. And, she decided to start a podcast, and she didn't want to do it solo. She was like, people want to listen to two people talking. So,
yeah, right.
She was like, "Hey, do you want to start a podcast with me?" And I'm like, "Yeah, sure. Let's do it." And we bonded over recovery and rock and roll. We've just always, the rock and roll is very important to both of us. And so we called the podcast Recovery Rocks because it does. And each episode ends with what we call a music minute, where we talk about, you know, the episode, we talk about a particular topic, and then the music minute, we wrap it up with a couple song suggestions that have to do with what we just talked about.
That's so thoughtful. Good for you guys. That's really cool.
Thank you. It's fun. It's really exciting. Like, the fact that we started this 5 years ago and it's still going, and just we're growing as people, and the audience is growing. It's just really cool.
Yeah, it's funny, you're telling that story about Lisa, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, this is what's so cool about when you finally get willing to get your shit together, for lack of a better term, when you really get like in a mindset where you say, "Man, I am just so ready to unlock this, figure this out for myself, do better," you're gonna find that like immediately almost somebody's hand gets extended to you. And they just see you in a way where you feel safe with them. And essentially, this is what Lisa does with this chip, right? She says, mm-hmm. I'm going to be your person. And you said, "I'm not even going to ask any questions. I'm just going to completely go with this." And look at you. You're 5 years later. And I know that the reason that I'm kind of harping on this moment is because if we were falling over a cliff, And some hand came over to save us, we would just grab it and we would hold on for dear life, and we would let that person pull us up. But in life, sometimes we get really choosy about who's going to be our person and our savior and our helper and our healer and our doctor. And we're like, we have all these rules for people. "I don't think they can help me, and I don't think they can help me." But when you're ready, somebody's hand is going to extend to you. And I just want you to fully trust it, because there's important people out there in this world who's they're looking for somebody else to go through this thing with. And there's so much power in that synergy. At least that's been my experience. And it sounds like you may have found something similar.
No, I mean, you explained it perfectly. It really is like to have that hand extended to me was like, I didn't even know I was falling off a cliff, you know, like She was there, and she has always been there. And there's also something really powerful to say about the role of mentorship in the just in life in general, but particularly as a writer, to have someone who's been through the publishing process, who could really hold my hand through it, because the publishing is just such a such a wild industry. And she answered all of my questions. She gave me so many books about publishing, gave me so many resources, like, and now I'm paying it forward. You know, like I love helping up and coming writers that like people that I see and I believe in. I'm like, you have a story to tell. Like, how can I help you? And that feels good. As you know, a big part of recovery is being of service. And it feels great for my recovery, of course, to help people by being of service. But it's also, now that I'm really deep in the publishing world, people are looking to me for questions and answers. And so it's like, the whole pay it forward system is really magical, and it really works. And I have a lot of friends here in New York that are artists, actors, writers, whatever, that envy my relationship with Lisa. They're like, God, I wish I had someone who was really, really fighting for my art. And I was just, it makes me feel even more grateful for her.
Yeah. Well, and again, go back to what I said. I'll bet you do have those people. Just stop pushing them to the side. Like, people are reaching out to help you and be a part of what you got going on all the time, usually. And one of the things that you wrote to us about in kind of our pre-notes was you said, I want to smash stigmas associated with sexuality and sobriety. And so, all right, let's go. We've been talking about, like, you know, sobriety a little bit. What are some of those stigmas surrounding sobriety? Shit like what? You won't be fun anymore? Like, what are you talking about?
That's a big one. It's for me, I thought, what am I going to do for fun? If I don't drink, how am I going to hang out with my friends? How am I going to go on a date? How am I going to have sex? How am I going to network? How am I going to do work happy hours? Like, I didn't know how. Like, alcohol was so ingrained in my life. I had no idea what my life could look like without it. So the reason that I am sober out loud is to be that visibility, to show people you can have fun. You can have a good time. You can hang out with your friends. You can have great sex. You can live a really wonderful, enriching life without alcohol. And the reason that I'm so vocal about it is because I didn't see that visibility growing up. There was nothing in between. It was either you drink or you go to AA. And there was like, and the people that went to AA were very anonymous and private, which is totally fine. Like that, but I think that anonymity, I didn't really get to see what thriving and sobriety looked like because I was in a bartending bubble, you know? So I'm out and proud on social media because I want people to see, like, you can do it. You don't need alcohol. Like, you may think you do, but you really, really don't.
So I had this woman on the show once. Her name was Angela Pugh. People can go back and listen to her episode, but she's a sober coach too in Kansas City. She's a really cool person. And she puts it so bluntly. She's like, listen, if happy hour's coming up and the first thing you think about is there going to be booze there versus what kind of people are going to be there for me to network? Mm. It's you should think about the fact that you have an alcohol problem. And she said something else that was so, like, just smashed me over the head. And she was like, sober people don't think about how much booze is going to be at all of these events. And you know, because you've been there. I know because I've been there. Like, that's the almost only thing you're kind of thinking about is, like, is there going to be a bar? Is there going to be drinks? What kind of drinks are they serving? Okay, other stigmas surrounding sobriety. What have you found?
Well, the reason that I wrote this book is really the intersection of the sobriety and sexuality. It's like, I'm not
dry humping.
Yeah. Just, you know, dry humping. I had no idea how to date, let alone have sex without alcohol. There was a lot of stigma, a lot of societal stigma. There's a lot of, you know, Hollywood representation of liquid courage that we've normalized, we've internalized as a culture. So it was a lot of, for me, my early sobriety and still is a lot of unlearning those problematic societal tropes and then figuring out who I am in a world that expects this behavior from me. And all of that, I think, is stigma. And stigma literally kills. Like, people die because they don't get sober. And I think that's an important part to add, because I can be this example of, yeah, you can have fun sober, but it's also like the barrier to entry to recovery is also really difficult for some people, and it's not always accessible. So the more visibility that we can provide, the better. And when I say stigma kills, I'm talking about the fact that earlier I said, you know, alcohol abuse is very rarely the problem. It's usually the symptom of the problem. A lot of people don't get to that root problem. A lot of people drink themselves to death or take their own lives because they never get to that root problem. And that's why I'm so passionate about the advocacy and smashing these stigmas that truly are harmful.
Yeah, that's such a great point. Well, and you're right. So many people will never get to that place. They'll just continue to medicate and take care of it themselves. And listen, like, I'm really compassionate toward that group of people. The journey's hard. It's really hard to unravel those pieces. It's really disgusting. Like, you have to look at pieces of yourself and things that you've done to people and others and yourself. And you have to, like shit gets real there for a little while, but it's all right. It's just kind of part of going through it, and not around it all the time is just to acknowledge it and then say to yourself finally, like, okay, but I guess I'm ready to do something different. And I know that that's just going to take some steps. So one of the things that I love to talk about, Tani, is the idea of environment. So listen, here's the truth. I don't hang out with a lot of people that I used to hang out with, pre-alcohol, post-alcohol. I just don't. I had to go separate ways. I couldn't be in a bar anymore, not because I was like so like thirsty for a beer or a shot of whiskey or something like that, but like I just did not want it in my life anymore. I'd grown up with it. You know, as I tell my story, my dad gave me my first sip of beer at like 4 or 5 years old. Like, I'm part of that story, and I just didn't want anything to do with it. So how was your environment, and how did it shift when you set down alcohol? What had to happen for you? Yeah, there's a lot of places to go, and you just take off.
Yeah, no, I like that question. I mean, there's a recovery term I'm sure you're familiar with, is like, they say, don't pull a geographic, which means like, don't just move and think that that's going to solve your problem, because your problems are going to go with you, even if you live in a new apartment or a new zip code. But
it's the truth.
Pulling a geographic worked for me. It really did. I left Texas. I left the bartending scene. I honestly don't know if I ever would have gotten sober if I stayed in that scene. I had this drive in me, as you now know, since I was 14, to write. And that even though I was self-medicating and so sick for so long, I still had this fire in me. I knew I wanted to write. And that's what got me out of the harmful situations, the harmful environment that I was in. So I moved to New York. I bought a one-way ticket. I didn't have anywhere to live. I literally just like sold everything I owned and figured shit out. And
I love that answer. I love it.
It's not something that I would recommend, but this is just what I did. Right. And I figured it out, and I met lots of other people who did the exact same thing. You know, like people moved to like New York, LA, Chicago all the time doing just that.
Yeah.
And I found my people. I found other writers. I found a sober community. And because I left, and I got sober here 5 months after moving to New York. So I didn't drink here for that long. I don't really have many memories of drunk New York, which I'm really grateful for.
Yeah, that's helpful. That's helpful.
So for me, it was a lot easier to physically remove myself from my environment. But I know that that's not an option for most people, or like recommended for most people. So I think the takeaway from what I'm talking about really is just finding a new community. And in the first chapter of my book, That first chapter is called Dating Yourself, because you can't find a healthy relationship with other people until you get to know who you are, that which is what you and I've been talking about this whole time. And in that chapter, I tell readers them, like, I highly recommend people just lean into their creativity, take classes, volunteer, just find new circles. And you're going to organically make new friends. You're going to organically feel better about yourself because you are giving back and you're learning. If you're volunteering, you're giving back and it feels really good to give back. If you're taking a dance class or a writing class or studying a foreign language, you're going to organically build real confidence, real courage, instead of relying on liquid courage. So this is like, it's a really roundabout answer to your question, but I think you're not going to get sober if you just stay in that same circle. If you're still hanging out with your friends that are inviting you to happy hour and pressuring you to drink, why would you stop drinking? You really have to find, there's got to be that fire in you. Like, for me, it was writing. Like, what is that fire in you that is, that really wants to live a healthier life?
So consider for just a moment, if you're listening to us right now, that it's not a mistake that you happen to pop on this particular podcast and that this happened to be our guest today and that this happened to be our subject matter. Like, consider that there's just not a mistake, that this is the message that's coming to you right now. Maybe you're somebody who's really on the fence about, how do I do this? What does my life look like without it? Am I going to have to get rid of all of my friends? Well, we've just talked about all that stuff. We've given you some clarity on the subject now. And so it's worth it. Wouldn't you agree to just take the steps? As I like to say, there's a lot of freedom on the other side of those conversations. Hasn't that been your experience?
Absolutely. And that is what was so scary, because I couldn't imagine what the other side was like,
right,
which is, again,
terrifying.
Which is why I think that the visibility is so, so, so important. And just if you're listening and you're even considering reevaluating your relationship with alcohol or substances or a problematic behavior, you know, like gambling, sex addiction, eating disorders, like this, it's all the same. This is all the same. It's just self-medicating a deeper issue. Yeah, maybe this is the sign that you needed to get into therapy, find a peer support group, or just journal about the feelings that are coming up. You know, like, it's, you're not alone. There are so many fabulous peer support groups, free online peer support groups that you can check out. Like, I think the longer you try to do it alone, I think is only going to be a disservice to yourself. And I think once I learned how to finally ask for help, that was such a breaking point for me. And now it's still difficult for me to ask for help sometimes, but once, it's very humbling. I don't know. Wouldn't you say, like, getting, like, being in recovery is very humbling because you're like, fuck, I can't do this on my own.
Well, in a lot of ways, you've figured some major things out, but there's still little things that you haven't kind of sorted through. Like, my experience is you kind of stumble on stuff, and where maybe, like, before it would take 2 or 3 weeks to get out of it, now it's like 2 or 3 days to get out of it, and you can kind of beat yourself up about those things. But yeah, that's the frustrating thing, is that you've been able to uncover some really big and heavy stuff, but you still realize that there's still some little stuff here that's got, you know, gonna need to get dealt with as well. I want to talk about the stigmas surrounding sexuality. So we've locked on sobriety. Now, what are some of the stigmas surrounding sexuality?
I mean, especially the stigmas for women are palpable. They are, you know, women are not supposed to be sexual beings. We're supposed to be quiet. We're not supposed to ask for what we want in bed. We're really not even taught pleasure. If you are lucky enough to receive sex ed in school, it's not abstinence based. If you do receive sex ed, it's usually how to use a condom and what to do, how to avoid pregnancy. There's no talk about female pleasure. There's no talk about the female anatomy usually. And if it is, it's only through the phallocentric lens of how it relates to the penis. So they're like, the clitoris is the only body part that exists for pleasure. It doesn't serve any other purpose. All of our body parts have multiple purposes. The clitoris is only to feel pleasure. And I wish someone told me that when I was younger, because a lot of the sex and dating that I had was largely performative, because I thought that was my role as a woman, was to please others in bed. And that earlier I mentioned how there was a lot of unlearning that I had to do in recovery. That was a big one of them. That was a big one. And especially, you know, and that's just with like cisgender heterosexual sex. You know, there's not even any conversation about queer sex. So there's just all of the stigma that comes from lack of visibility and lack of information. That's also what I'm trying to combat with this book. The book really is the intersection of sobriety and sexuality. And I know those are really heavy topics. And that's why I wanted to call the book something silly and fun, like dry humping. I want the readers to know we're going to talk about some heavy shit, but we're going to laugh. We're going to have a lighthearted approach. We're gonna do this. It's gonna be okay.
Well, as I like to say to so many people, it's so important to acknowledge that we're at a time in our lives where clearly there's a shift taking place, and a lot of new thoughts and ideas are being brought to the table. Things that we've never considered or even been open to talk about before. And it's okay to say, like, we're not saying we're gonna get everything right. We're just saying that we're gonna explore this a little bit more and see what it is, you know, kind of all about. It's so interesting to hear you talk about performative, because I, man, you said that. And I honestly, like my real thought was, God, I've only thought about that from a male standpoint before, of like watching porn and trying to be like the male figure in the thing. But yeah, why would I be so naive to think that women aren't watching it and trying to do the same thing, right?
Yeah, and it's so funny that you say that, because I don't really think about how the porn is going to negatively impact the male performance.
Oh my God, it jacks us up.
Trust me, I am pro porn, I am pro sex work. A lot of the research that I did for this book is actually I interviewed some sober porn stars and sober sex workers.
Wow. I want the files. That would be fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, I went deep into the research here, but I am pro sex work 100%. Porn has changed significantly than the porn I grew up watching. It's very different now.
Yeah.
I think that's also worth pointing out. And remember, porn is entertainment. It is not a how-to guide. Although there are some now, there's more educational porn out there, which I think is great. But I wish that I knew that when I was younger. I wish I knew that these were also just actors performing, because I thought that that's what I was supposed to do. I thought, these are the noises I should make. These are the positions I should like. This is, I should want my partner to do this. And no one ever told me that it was just entertainment. So, yeah.
It's such a big bomb. You don't know this about me, but my story, one of my big hits was like, I discovered porn at 6 years old, and I found my dad's adult magazines, and like it fucking wrecked my sexual life, like wrecked how I thought about it. And I got with therapists pretty like in my 20s and started to dive down some roads. And so at least my whole life wasn't a shit show. But like, man, it's unbelievable, because you just said it, like you can put yourself into a relationship, even with somebody you really like and you're really into, and you still feel like you're performing all the time. You still feel like, and then what's dangerous about that, and people that haven't thought about this, I'm going to blow your mind right now, but you can get yourself into a point where you're not even thinking about your own pleasure anymore. You're not even thinking about like, is this what I like? Does this even feel good to me right now? Like you're like an actor in one of those movies, sort of just going through these motions, and like, it's not good. Boy, it's not good. I'd find a different way to do it. Really find a
please,
different way to
please, please do.
It's, yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, again, like we're not anti-porn here. It's just, I think it just a little bit of perspective of just like, this is a fun thing to watch. And sure. Remember that, like, you know, you're not going to watch, you're not going to go to a movie theater and think that you're supposed to be like, I don't know, some actor. Like, but for some reason we project that onto porn and it just, it doesn't need to be that way. It's in fact, I rarely say should and shouldn't, but it shouldn't be that way. Yeah. And there's just when you, at least for me, the performative element of sex and sexuality, that was so hard for me to unpack because I grew up reading the, you know, porn aside, women's magazines, teen magazines, you know, 10 ways to please your man. Right. And
I remember all that shit,
you know, and it's just like, you know, if you don't have sex with your man 3 times a week, then he's going to get bored. And it's like, fuck, right. They're putting a lot, like this is a lot of pressure.
I know. Yeah. Yeah. That's so funny. I remember all those magazines, Cosmo and all that. I mean, that literally was the headline of every magazine. It was like 5 tips to please your man. Do your thing. And it hasn't really even been until the last, I don't know, maybe 15 years or so,
yeah,
where it's been like top 10 ways to please yourself. Like we're starting yes. to get a little bit better at the conversation. All right. So what are some other stigmas surrounding sexuality that you feel
everything we just talked about,
yeah,
that all leads to stigma. That leads to people, the sexual repression is what I'm talking about. Repressing your sexuality, even as a straight person, can lead to a lot of sexual dysfunction. And especially for queer people, I'm bisexual and I'm very familiar with, you know, quote, the gay bar. There's this rite of passage where, you know, you turn 18 or you get a fake ID and you go to the gay bar and you're with your people, you know, and especially if you come from a family that does not support queerness, having that community can be truly life-changing. And when you find that sense of self in a bar, it can be very, very damaging to queer people. And people in the LGBT community are twice as likely to develop substance abuse disorder, twice as likely to commit suicide. And that is, again, when I'm saying I want to smash stigma, it's because stigma is literally killing people. It's literally putting people on the streets. It's kicking people out of their homes. And that is how then they find comfort in substances or dangerous behaviors. And if we don't have the visibility, then these stigmas will continue.
So well said. Tani Laura's got a new book coming out. When is this thing going to drop? Is it pre-order right now? It's called Dry Humping. It's right there in the top right. When can people get their hooks on it?
Hooks activated September 19th. And we're doing a pre-order campaign. If you submit your pre-order receipt, go to my Instagram, go to the link in my bio, okay. Submit your pre-order receipt. And we're going to give you what we're calling a dry humping starter guide. And it's an excerpt from the book. It's queer, being sober and queer 101, sober socializing 101, as well as some, like a sobriety glossary of like all of these different terms that I learned in sobriety that I wish I knew before.
Yeah. Can I ask a really strange question?
Please.
Oh my God. This is, I can't even believe I'm going to articulate this, I'm going to say it anyways. So like, okay, you were straight and then I'm assuming you had a bisexual experience. Did that make it, did you become more comfortable with yourself after both of those experiences? Did be who you were? This is so messy, but the person you are, did it get clearer after that moment or get more confusing after that moment?
When I realized I was bi?
Yes.
So,
and then actually did something about it and like you found, yeah. Like, oh my God. Yeah.
So I knew that I didn't have the word bisexual, but I knew pretty young, like early teens, like around the time I was writing these articles, I knew very early on that I was attracted to men and women.
Yeah.
And I'm very grateful that I have queer family members. So that visibility definitely helped me because I did not feel any shame. My mother was very accepting, and she had queer friends. So I didn't feel any shame or stigma. And I'm so, so grateful for that.
For sure.
But what I did feel was because most of my relationships and sexual experiences were with men, I did feel like I wasn't quote unquote bisexual enough to really take pride in the word. And so, but in sobriety, once you get all of this shit out of your head, you can really clear the mind and work on the other stuff. Yeah. And for me, that was queerness and learning more about bisexuality and realizing that you don't have to be like, it's not a 50-50 thing. You don't have to, you don't have to like activate your sexuality. There's no punch card. Like there's nothing like that. It literally is. It literally is just attraction. Bisexuality is just attraction to multiple genders. That's it. And so once I let myself research that in sobriety, that was a huge game changer for me.
Yeah. Just felt more ground. That's what I was kind of getting at. Like you felt like, okay, this is the real me. This is the authentic me. This is like, this is who I am a little bit.
Yeah. And it's that with, you know, with bisexuality, with my mental health diagnoses, with just all of my quirks, you know, I was able to really figure out who I am and embrace who I am, and hiding from all of those things were what kept me sick. That's what kept me drinking. And it's everyone's story is different, but for me, I know for a fact I would not have addressed a whole bunch of my shit if I kept drinking.
It's the truth, man, because when you stop drinking, then it's like, it's so in your face. Oh,
it really is. It's a mirror. Like you can't, and that's the thing is like, you can't unlearn it.
Yeah,
you know, right. it's like, okay, I have chronic anxiety. I need to know, I need to deal with this on a daily basis. So I take medication, I meditate, I do yoga. I have like so much shit I have to do just to be like a functioning baseline, not even to thrive, just to be like a baseline, decent human.
Yeah.
I have so much shit I have to do.
You're like a meme. Do you realize how much it takes to just be freaking normal for me every day?
Literally. Oh my God. Yeah. It's so, and it's like, again, the performance wasn't just in the bedroom. It was just this mask, life? Just trying to be quote normal, trying to just be this version of myself I thought people wanted. And you just can't.
It's exhausting.
It is exhausting.
Yes, that's the truth. All right, look at right here, putting it right in the middle of us. It's called dry humping. She called out the date, September 19th, a guide to dating, relating, and hooking up without booze, which is totally possible. And we didn't even get really into it today, but there's so many really delicious non-alcoholic options out there that they've actually made being social and doing the whole thing out there with a drink in your hand that doesn't look like a bottle of water. Real possible. And do you partake in any of that stuff, or do you just not deal with it at all?
I do. I will say the non-alcoholic drink scene is definitely, I think it helps my recovery. I loved beer. I loved craft beer. Yeah. And there's a lot of really good non-alcoholic beers now. So I'm able to still nurture that side of me. And sometimes like there's just something really satisfying about having a quote unquote beer. And it's been so long since I've had a real beer that it just tastes, it's just as good to me. And there's also like, there's really good, of course there's good non-alcoholic beers, there's non-alcoholic tequilas and stuff, but there's also really interesting, like just nuanced flavored drinks. Like botanical extracts and stuff like that are really interesting. And
you ever tried Ritual?
Yeah, Ritual's great. I do their non-alcoholic tequila. I make like NA margaritas and it's good. I also understand how that could be triggering for some people.
For sure. Because it does have a little bit of the thing. Yeah.
Exactly. It could hit a little too close to home. And I totally get that, which is why I recommend if you don't want like a non-alcoholic version of something you've abused in the past, yeah, look into some of the other stuff.
All right. Fair enough. Do what you want. There it is. Okay. So dry humping's coming out in just a little bit. Thanks for being on the podcast too. Appreciate you.
Thank you for having me. You're a great interviewer. This was good.
We have three goals with Learn from People Who Lived It. One, to help you feel less alone. Two, encourage you to seek out a coach, a therapist, a church, anyone who can help you get through your journey and find some healing. Three, when you're ready, share your story with us.
Find Learn from People Who Lived It wherever you get podcasts. Search it using all one word, Learn from People Who Lived It.